Let's start with the minutes. Everybody approved the minutes? Everybody get a chance to read them? Any changes? Motion to approve?
Seconded.
So done. All right, thank you. Okay, we'll get our presentations from staff and go from there. Not that I know of. Well, there is one. Ryan Jorley has moved back to New Jersey.
Yes, he has.
So, we'll miss him.
We're going to miss him. And very soon, we're going to miss Sydney from Ohio. He's over here. I'll be presenting tonight. He's jumping ship down to Miami.
So, okay.
Has she been here long enough to...
13 months.
I told Rob that I could miss me one time. It was a young man's game.
Yeah. Oh, here you go.
We only had her here, I guess, on a sabbatical, 1 year sabbatical. Going back to Florida, right? All right. Well, I wanted to give you a little bit of a preview on that you've heard about that new MRIP estimates coming out. Finally, after it's been a long, long process, been involved, we finally are seeing what the adjustments that they've made to the effort part of the survey. So I'll set this up in case there are people in the audience that are really unfamiliar with it, but there's two components are needed to create catch estimates that NOAA used to create the recreational catch estimate. It's the average catch per angler, which is the access point angler intercept survey, which is why I always call it the APIS, and you multiply that by the effort, which is the number of angler trips. What is the at the basis of these new MRIP measurements is the way effort is now being estimated. Since 1981, there was a coastal household effort survey that was employed, and that used a random digit dialing method to contact anglers located within 50 miles of the coastline, and that's state in Virginia. It wasn't very effective from the very get-go because there was such a low incidence of fishing households. They might have to call 20 or more households before they find one where there was an individual there that saltwater fish. In addition, there was a correction factor that was necessary to account for in-state non-coastal households as well as all non-state anglers to correct for sampling bias. As time went on and cell phones replaced landlines, there was even more sampling bias because now even more households did not have a landline. So they couldn't be sampled and creating a greater sampling bias. And the addition of caller ID meant there was even more non-response. So when we get a phone call, even on their home phone, dial phone, if we go back that far, and it would have the caller ID. If it wasn't one they recognized, they wouldn't answer, wait for them to leave a message. The NIMS contractors were instructed they didn't leave a message. They try, I think, four more times at different times of the day, see if they can catch it at home. So it just, everyone was aware something was going to have to happen. And really what pushed it along even more was Congress had authorized the National Research Council in 2004 to review the methodology NOAA was using for the whole program. At that time was the Marine Fisheries Recreational Statistical Survey, or the MRFS, as it was called. They came out in 2006 with a list of things that they thought should and could be improved upon. NITS sent upon that, and what I sort of chuckle at, the first thing they did was change the name of the program. had been the MRFIS, and now it's the Marine Recreational Information Program, or MRIP. Or as we said when they introduced it to us at the RecTech Committee, that's a perfect acronym. It stands for MRFS, Rest in Peace. But they also started a number of research and pilot programs in 2008. But probably the first thing recreational anglers noticed was this National Saltwater Angler Registry. 2010, everybody was supposed to sign up for it. NOAA Fisheries was going to create this giant telephone book, that's what they called it, a universal telephone book of all saltwater anglers. And the first year, the sign-up was free. And NIMS, Congress had allowed NIMS to charge whatever it cost to run the system. So essentially that first year, they were determining what it was going to cost them to run it. And by the fall of 2010, they let anglers and states know it's going to cost somewhere between $20 and $25 per angler. And any state that had a license at that time, especially for in-state anglers, wait a minute, our license, our saltwater fishing license is less than that. So they pretty quickly, from Maine to Florida, the Gulf Coast, the West Coast, everyone but Hawaii and Puerto Rico, came up with some program to get this data and then supply it to NOAA Fisheries. And that's we came by the Fisherman Identification Program. And that, you know, that was all in an effort to improve the effort survey. We did have, it's almost like the ground tremor we had in 2012 here when Rob was at the podium, a very, very mild earthquake. Well, they had a very, very mild, by comparison, recalculation in 2012. And it was,
I didn't call it.
We all stood here, what is that? But it created, when the dust settled on that one, the estimates were maybe 30%, some were up, some were down from the old MRIP estimates. So it was pretty minor, and I think on average the precision estimate was a little bit higher. So that didn't create much of didn't get people's attention, but they at the same time were launching a number of new angler catch protocols, and they started development of a mail effort survey. Now initially they were going to revamp the telephone survey, but as they got into these pilot programs, they realized, hey, we're getting much better results with a mail survey. Now that we've created this database where we've got the universe of saltwater anglers. We don't have to waste time sending it to grandmother or whoever else in a household. They said, there's a number of pluses on this. And they began benchmarking in 2015. Because what they had found from the pilot studies, one, they had significantly higher response rates. I guess that's the PEOO. Very significantly higher response rates. It did not negatively impact timeliness of the data. And I don't sense that mid-Atlantic states are concerned about the timeliness of it, of the data, as much as the accuracy. But in the South Atlantic area, they've got a lot of small quotas that they're trying to manage in real time, and states wanted that data just as fast as they could get it. They didn't want it to go beyond the current 45-day turnaround point. But it didn't increase that. But the biggest thing, it reduced the coverage and sampling error bias. Little did they know that it really was going to change the trip estimate as well. So as we move into 2015, it's when they started side-by-side benchmarking of the two surveys, the Coastal Household Telephone Survey and the now the mail survey. There's a number of things that have to take place, and there's still a work in progress, but they began incorporating the new estimates to be into the stock assessment scenarios. they began a calibration model in September of 2015, and it was finally ready to start working on recalibration in 2017. Meanwhile, the Coastal Household Telephone Survey is still going all the way through 2016, and last year, the two were running parallel to benchmark. We began to see some re-estimation of historical catch in May of this year, and that process continues. Likewise, the projections on ACLs, and it's an ongoing process. But the actual transition from utilizing the telephone survey to mail survey was done, and starting January of this year, all that's used is a mail survey. They're continuing to to fully update all the stocks to calibrate them and update the catch history or estimation history and projections of the ACLs is a continuing process. Alex is going to give you a couple examples of black sea bass and striped bass, but generally speaking, the catch estimates for the recreational fishery are at least double among all species. I've just put this up here that there was a total of 8 years of testing, 6 different MRIP projects, and 2 independent reviews to get to this point.
What was double, Lewis?
Pardon me?
What was double?
The
respondents?
the resulting... From the mail survey, the resulting trip estimate. Well, the final estimate. Some of the trip, in other words, anglers were able to sample more anglers, but the average angler was reporting a lot more trips than they did on the telephone survey.
Does staff have a distribution on a wave-by-wave basis of the number of angler trips per angler? So they've got an estimate. So my problem with a mail survey is the Joe fish 2 times a year guy is not going to send in a survey saying I didn't fish in the last two months. And there are 250,000 anglers in Virginia, more or less, saltwater anglers.
In your opinion, Ella has a different opinion, but I'm not
based on, and maybe the numbers have changed based on license change sales and the fisherman identification program that including an allowance for under 16, including an allowance for noncompliance, that's somewhere around 250,000. Rob and I have gone over these numbers years ago. Now, maybe they've changed since then, but I don't think so. But the point is, if they're saying it's 800,000 anglers, or they're saying that we've got, you know, a distribution function that doesn't have a big long tail to no effort, then there is something wrong with the way they're doing the numbers. I'm sorry. There are a large number of, especially the angler identification program, who just don't fish every week or even once a month.
I find it very hard to believe, and it's unfortunate, or maybe fortunate for Ryan, but he had the opportunity to talk to John Foster, which is kind of the guru of this sampling design, because that had always been my contention, is that you need to determine what the total number of anglers are. And if you're still saying it's something in this, we'll just say 500,000 or greater, our records just don't indicate it, even if when you look at the number of tickets, if you will, that get written for people that should either have a license or FIP and don't.
And that's a 20%. That was a 20% number when we did this.
To Ryan, that's not necessary. Now, That's as far as I can go and comment on that. But apparently they have, the way the process is done, the way the calculations are done, and as always, I presented the simplest number of trips, average catch, trips times catch equal total catch. But there's, I've always called it that black box where NOAA, you know, they weight different things at different levels. But I can't, I'm just...
Like I said, it would be most enlightening to see the average number of trips per angler that they're using for their distribution, for their calculation, on a wave-by-wave basis.
I think they could...
That's a request of staff to get that information.
How many people does NOAA think we have? How many saltwater fish?
Well, I'd have to look at their estimated number. But generally, it is 500,000. At one time, it was 1,000,000, but the estimate has come down. Total number of saltwater anglers.
Okay.
How many people fill out the FIP thing? How many of those are
right
there?
Right about 55,000 to 56,000.
That's amazing. Okay.
Well, okay, but it's 60,000, and then there's
40,000. I would guess it would be 600, because what is the purpose? Why would you fill that out?
So you don't get a ticket.
Yeah, but if you're on the but if the boat has a license, Virginia has boat licenses.
You still have to fill that out if you have a boat license.
When the owner of the boat.
That's, I've never had that asked of me by.
When the owner
anybody.
Of the boat gets a boat license, the game department includes when you mail out the sticker. The card that indicates, yep, the way the regulation is written, anyone that's legally exempt from being required to purchase a saltwater fishing license that's 16 or older needs the FIP registration.
Right.
Now,
or they already own a fishing license.
Who gets it and who doesn't, that I can't comment, but I've talked to law enforcement about it. And, you know, early on, there was their biggest problem was on the piers, where a lot of people, yeah, they're here one time, you're Virginia Beach Pier, they don't know, say, oh yeah, I can fish for a year, your license, come on out, and they weren't always registered. But even that compliance has gone up. I don't sense. I've tried to get them to come up with a figure, just in their normal. Actually, I've asked our IT person, could they just check for that and just. You don't have to do it, but if you do, just give us an idea what percentage of non-compliance we've got out there. They need an FIP, but didn't have it.
There's 50,000 FIP, 55,000. There's another 100,000 licenses sold between boat and individual.
You say so.
I mean, that's maybe it's 120, but it's what? Yeah, so there's kind of 180,000 people, and then take into account 30% noncompliance, and you're at 250,000. Plus you're under 16 and over 65s, and I don't know what the deal is with over 65s right now.
Lifetime.
Well, they've got a lifetime, but how that gets counted? Yeah, I know it's a license, but. It does. How it gets added into the 110,000 that Rob said, 110, 120,000. Because people normally look at licenses as the annual sales numbers. And somebody who's over 65 gets one license one time, and then they're done.
That's true. That's
why it's an annual. So not for them. For over 65, it's a one time and you're done license.
But they still need to. FIP number.
No, they don't. You get a license.
Yeah.
But don't you need a FIP number every year?
Not if you have a license. And that license, which was created by the legislature in 2011 for another purpose, meets the regulation requirements. It was really created by the legislature to allow Virginia residents who are over 65 to enjoy reciprocity with Maryland and Potomac River fisheries. Because when they went to Maryland, Maryland folks said, well, it's a license reciprocity. You've got to have a Virginia license to get license reciprocity. It's like Catch 22. And we wouldn't sell them one because they were over 65.
So the point is, it's kind of 250, maybe 300,000.
If you want to argue how NOAA does...
So, I mean, the problem, don't get me wrong, if you say we're catching more fish, then that's great, because that goes back into the how we're splitting up the catch over the years and what are the right numbers and all that, allocation issues. But I still have trouble... I have trouble with the numbers showing up. At times it was 850,000 is the number they were using for recreational fishermen. And if you look at and again, this is why I want to understand the numbers on a wave by wave basis. If they say during a wave we have 250,000 or 100,000 people that are going six times, and that's the way we get the numbers, then there is something fundamentally wrong, because at least half the people who are recreational fishermen in Virginia don't go fishing in April and or March and April, probably three quarters. And even in May and June, you know, there's people who are I summarize my boat because I fish for stripers in the fall. You know,
Well,
I bet that data is available. You've already made the request. Let's see if they can get it.
Yeah, let's see what we can do. Thanks, John.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question, if you don't mind. Of the with all the recent concern about data breaches, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and I hope you don't think this is off topic. If there are 112,000 registered license holders and X number of lifetime license holders, who's that information available to? I'm assuming the state turns it over to the feds for the fisheries identification program, but who else has access to that data?
Well, it comes into the game department. The
Department of Game and Inland Fisheries.
You have enough money, you can get a copy of it?
I'm leading up to that. Can I, as an individual citizen, get a list of all the license holders?
I can't answer that question.
Could anybody else on staff answer that? Okay, thank you.
State legislature actually, legislation.
We get that for, you know, commercial listings, and for many years, quite frankly, I never gave out phone numbers, but this year I was told, no, we need to give out phone numbers.
Okay, thanks.
Question asked,
so
question
that,
answered.
Yeah,
thank you.
That database, by law, it's available, and you're supposed to charge a reasonable fee, and I haven't figured out what that means. Especially because it's just a giant file.
Okay.
I have a copy from 2003.
Interesting. All right, proceed, please.
All right, I'm going to turn it over to Alex.
Oh, that was it. Thanks, Alex.
Thank you, Lewis. So what I'm going to provide to you is just a comparison between a few species, looking at the old MRIP and the new MRIP estimates. Starting out with striped bass, because striped bass will be actually the first species to use the new calibrated estimates in a stock assessment, which is scheduled for peer review in November, and then the results of that stock assessment will be provided at the winter meeting in February. So old MRIPs are referring to the pre-calibrated estimates, so what's been used in the past for stock assessments, fishery management plans. The new MRIP refers to the calibrated MRIP estimates, so the change from the coastal household survey to the mailing survey. And what you'll see is quite a jump. For striped bass in particular, we're talking 2 to 3 times increase in harvest. And that's not just for striped bass, it's for all species. You'll see a jump in harvest. And it's not just 2017, it's actually the entire time. So 1981 to 2017. I only include from 2000 to 2017 to keep everything on one table. Moving to black sea bass, again, we see similar trends. See an increase in the new MRIP harvest estimates, not quite as large as striped bass. Looks about a doubling in harvest. So I think the question on everyone's mind is, you know, what does this mean? We see an increase in harvest, but what does that really mean? And I don't think everyone has a complete grasp on what that means at this point, since it's so new. But what we do know is that these new MRIP estimates are not going to be used for management until they're incorporated into an assessment. So with a new stock assessment, when these are incorporated into a new stock assessment, you might have changes in reference points. And it depends on which species. It's going to be different for each species dependent on how they're managed. At that point, again, you know, if it's not coming to a stock assessment, we'll be using the old MRIP values to base management. But for something new like striped bass, we'll learn as we go along the way. And we're just going to move on from here. And that's what I have with the comparison of these old and new estimates. So I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have about these changes.
The new numbers are going to throw everything, our history, our calculations of stock size, everything out the window, correct?
Correct.
It's going to cause it to have to be revised.
Well,
it says
we've been catching twice as much as we thought we were catching in the stocks that haven't collapsed at the numbers that we were told they would collapse at. If they're still healthy, we have to go back and reassess stock size and landings and everything.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
I have a question.
All right.
This is going to be included into the new stock assessment we're doing now. So it's going to show there's been a lot more fish removed. So that's going to make the stock in worse shape.
Or better.
Well, it's going to also say that there are probably a lot more fish out there than we may have realized.
Yeah, we don't know.
That's the optimistic statement because that's not how Atlantic states work. I mean, what I'm concerned about is this. If we've been removing average weight two times as many fish as they thought, and I'm sure this would be up and down the coast, not just Virginia. And if it lowers the size of the stock, they've already cut us 25% on the commercial side. You know exactly what we caught. There's no doubt about it. You have to report. So our numbers is pretty precise. You know, there might be people who lie, and there's not much you can do about it. It's up to law enforcement. But in general, the numbers are going to be pretty good. I can see them cutting us more, even though we had nothing to do with it. Is that a possibility, Rob?
Well, again, I think it is difficult to know how this works because about 8 years ago, they changed their modeling on that. There used to be something called the BPA, and some of you might remember that the recreational groups were intent on seeing that the discard mortality rate for summer flounder, they all thought it was less. And John Lucy and someone else did a study at BIMS, and it was dropped, that rate was dropped from 20% to 10%.
Yep.
The effect in the BPA was you all of a sudden had less fish bodies going into the model, and what turned out, quotas were tighter, and the recreational harvest limit was tighter. Does this work different because it's a forward projecting model? We don't know. I asked the question that you asked at the Mid-Atlantic Council, and John Hare, who's the director of the Northeast Fishery Science Center, said, we don't know. He said the first step, and they're working on summer flounder and striped bass in the first two in November, the first step is to see if we can load this new MRIP data without blowing up the model. That's what he said. So I said, well, okay, so if you conquer that, then what does that mean for other species that have to use the new MRIP? And he said there's going to be no relationship among these different assessments that they do. It's all, you know, all up to the particular species, the way it behaves in the model. So I don't think we know, Ernie. I don't think we have an idea. The one thing I know about summer flounder and striped bass, both were relatively close to, you know, having a problem with the biomass. Summer flounder last benchmark 2015 was 58%. That means it just had to get to a little distance to hit the problem area of being overfished. Strike Pass was also trending down through 2015. Those are the things I worry about. And then the one thing to really worry about is both Strike Pass and Summer Flounder, the first two they're going to do, have not had very good recruitment. You know, it's been average for Strike Pass, mostly in Virginia, for the last 7 years. Maryland's been either below average or average. Summer Flounder is even a worse picture because Summer Flounder have had a strong recruitment since 2009, and a lot of the recruitments have been lower. So that has to mix in here. I mean, that's in the model that they do, the recruitment. They have to figure out how to put that in there too. So,
you know, if it is trending down, and I don't see it. I mean, you know, Strike Bass is in real good shape, far as I'm concerned. If it is trending down and they've been removing twice as many as they thought they were removing, that might be the reason for a downward trend. And, you know, I'm concerned about that. Just like, you know, we've been cut 25%. We're supposed to 3 years. I don't think I'll not live long enough to ever see any of it back. I don't want to lose any more. But, you know, we have a fishery that's exploded, a recreational fishery that did not even exist 5 or 6 years ago over on Assateague. The whole beach is lined with vehicles, mostly New Jersey, Maryland, out of state ones. The whole beach is lined with them. Striped bass fishing in the spring. Used to be it was like 3 or 4 people that did it, and I'd give them bunkers so they could go. Now I wouldn't even, that didn't even exist. So, you know, these numbers, They never even counted those numbers. They were never surveyed because it didn't exist.
Do the assessments in November, Summer Flounder, Strike Bass, then have a peer review, and then come back to the ASMSC in the case of Flounder, the Mid-Atlantic Council, and the ASMSC. We're looking at February. For Strike Bass, it may be by the May meeting that we'll know what management initiatives can be taken, either up or down. I don't know. For Summer Flounder, it's going to be later because that's a joint plan with the council. And the council goes by National Marine Fisheries Service, and they have to publish a provisional and then a final rule. So that's going to take longer into 2019. But we'll have sort of a pretty good idea of where things are going by February.
Question for Mr. O'Reilly. I don't want to digress too much. It's just something caught my attention. You said something about recruitment in the last 7 years for striped bass has been down. Wasn't there a period of like 02 to 10 where there were 2 or 3 years that were the highest on record?
89 was good. 93 was great.
I remember that.
2001 was pretty good. 2003 was pretty good. 2007 is the last time where it was fairly good. And then after that, it's been either average or below average. Because we look at the Baywise, you know, Maryland's in there too. So VIMS is coming back with really an average composite.
And that's that same 55-year survey where they do the toes and they count the young of the year?
Well, no, this is the specialized same survey of VIMS where they go out. And they start in about 68, I think, 1968.
Huh.
So, but it's, yeah, recruitment's not. But the strange thing is, if you try and get a straight answer, which I've tried, they feed in all the different recruitments up and down the coast for striped bass, for summer flounder. And then it's the model they're working with which determines the net effect of recruitment. So watching the surveys here, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, North Carolina, and you look at those surveys, you still don't know until it's put into the model.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm like Ernie. I from what I've seen the last two, even summer, spring, year-round, I mean, the striped bass from 18 to 22 to 24, it reminds me of 89, 90. I mean, I've never seen anything like it, you know, the fish this big.
We've seen them all summer, like 14 to 16 inches.
You can't, I throw a cast net
in
Lynnhaven
in the summer
at Pharrell's house and a cast net at 7, striped bass.
Please let us go from 20 inches recreational to 19. passed that back in May. So, yeah, I'm watching other fish there as well. But, you know, we have to wait, unfortunately, because it's a situation where we got all the other states combined and all that data combined.
Gotcha.
So I'm glad to hear your report.
Yeah. One throw of a cast net, five, and one I had seven striped bass in the cast net.
You did better than those hooking line fishermen.
Yeah. And I let them go. I was trying to get mullet. I mean, that was in June, July.
All right.
You're doing pretty good in Tanger and Pokemon size right now, recreational fishing on strike now.
That's it?
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
We can certainly send this information to you.
We appreciate that.
Done this work up for seven or eight species.
Yeah.
And we can send that so you can look. Lewis can ask that question with the next rec tech meeting, which, if I got it right, the average number of trips per angler on a wave basis.
Distribution.
We can certainly ask that question.
The distribution is important.
Pardon?
The distribution.
Thank you.
I think I'll contact you directly.
Okay.
ACC is clean, which any private citizen can do.
Good. Okay.
All right.
All right.
Good evening, everybody.
Yeah.
So this is the Summer Flounder Commercial Issues Amendment. It's a very long amendment, so I'm going to try to make this as succinct as possible.
All right. Let me. There is a meeting here in two nights on this.
Wednesday
is that?
Wednesday night, 7 p.m.
Okay, 7 p.m. All right.
So back in December of 2014, the council and the board had a scoping period to identify key issues for commercial amendments. And 3 years later, in December 2017, they approved the range of alternatives for public hearings, which I'm going to go through tonight. So there are four main issues. They all pertain to commercial summer flounder. The first is to requalify the criteria for federal commercial moratorium permits to address the latent effort in the fishery. The second is to modify the commercial quota allocations. The third is to address the commercial landings flexibility in the council's fishery management plan. And the third is to revise the FMP objectives for summer flounder. I'm going to go through each one and explain the alternatives under them. So alternative 1A is to address the latent effort in the moratorium permits. So summer flounder fishermen are required to have a federal commercial moratorium permit, and alternative 1A would not impose any action and keep status quo. There are currently 941 of these permits. So alternative 1B would requalify the criteria to maintain that permit. So any permit not meeting this new qualification criteria would be canceled and could not be renewed. There would also be no new entrants into these qualifications, and they claim that it'll have no impact on the state level permits. So there's seven sub-alternatives under this alternative 1B that combine of various qualification time periods and landing thresholds. So starting from 1 through 7, it's 55% in this fourth column would be eliminated and decreasing from there through the seven options. And we'd like industry feedback on which of these options would be most suitable for Virginia. So the second issue is the commercial allocation, which is really our biggest issue in this amendment. So alternative 2A would keep status quo, the state's allocation. Virginia currently has 21% of the coastwide quota for summer flounder, and this is based on the 1980 through 1989 landings. We have the second highest quota after North Carolina with 27%. So So alternative 2B is to adjust the state quotas based on the recent biomass distribution. They believe that a northern shift in biomass has occurred from 1980 through 1989 and the 2007 to 2016 time period. So this would be translated into a change in regional allocation. The Northeast Fisheries Science Center surveys are the only ones that are being used because these are the surveys that cover both time periods. So I'm going to explain under 2B the two different options. So 2B1 is a relative percent change in exploitable biomass in the northern region, and this percent change is then applied to the current northern region allocation. So in 2007 through 2017, they estimate an 80% biomass in the northern region. In 1980 through 1989, there was a 67% biomass estimate. So the percent change would be 80 minus 67 divided by 27 times 100. So that equals a 19% increase in their regional allocation. This is then applied to their current northern region allocation at 32.46%, and that would translate to a 38% northern region allocation. So I'm going to show some graphs here to fully explain that. So if we're just focusing on Virginia in the yellow, we start with 21%, which is our status quo allocation. 67% is the southern region allocation of the coastwide quota. So if we're looking at the third column, the Virginia has 31% of our southern region quota. So the northern region includes states from New York up. New Jersey is in a region of its own, but it's included in our southern region. And then there's a Delmarva region. And North Carolina is also in our southern region. So from here down is the southern region. We have 67% of the coastwide quota. 31% belongs to Virginia. And then if the 2B1 option, where the increase to the north is applied, we would then go down to 61% of the coastwide quota, which translates to a 19% state allocation. So ultimately, we lose 1.95% of our state allocation. Is everyone following so far?
Yeah, the difference between 21 is where we are now, the first column, 21%+ as compared to the 19% there. That is a 9% change in percentage, but it ends up just slightly less than 2% of the coastwide amount. So the way that this was set up, it's a little bit tricky because you've got two regions and the percentages really matter at the very end on that last column.
So I'm going to go through a couple of hypothetical situations to show what would happen to our quota. So using 6.3 million pounds, which is our current 2018 coastwide quota, if the 2B1 option is applied and we go down to 19%, we would lose 145-ish thousand pounds. If we use the 5% average, 8.4 million pound quota, 5-year average. Going down to 19%, we would lose 163,000 pounds. And then the 10-year average at 10.71 million pounds, we would lose roughly 208,000 pounds. So it's not looking great. So under 2B2, this applies an absolute change rather than a percent change. So because the absolute change is 13%, this would be added to the northern region, and then the 45% of the northern region would be subtracted from 100 to get 54%. Bless you. And that's a 13% regional shift relative to the whole coast. And this is the largest shift in allocation. So again, same concept. We go from 21% and a 67% of the regional allocation to a 54% regional allocation and a 17% state allocation. This is a 19% change relative to the existing state allocations, and we would lose 4.1% of our state allocation. So the first option, we didn't lose any. The second option, we would lose 1.9, I believe, 9.5. And this option, we lose 4.1%. Again, using the current quota, if we were to go from 21 to 17%, we would lose 281,000 pounds using this year's quota. If we had the 8.4 million pound quota, we would lose roughly 700,000 pounds. And if we had a 10.71 million pound, we would lose 439,000 pounds. This is a little less because the quota is higher. So those would be the losses for us. The third option under this second issue would be choosing a state allocation above a commercial quota trigger. So anything above these triggers would be allocated to states that have less than 1% of the current quota. So Delaware, New Hampshire, Maine would get 0.33% each, and the remaining states would get 12.375% each. So alternative 2C1 is the five-year average, setting the trigger at 8.4 million pounds. So if we were given a hypothetical 9 million pound quota, anything above 8.4 million pounds would be divided amongst the states in this fashion. And the 2C2 is the 10.71 million pounds. And this is the five-year and the 10-year average. So the fourth option under this second issue is a SCUP model. So using three different time periods, a winter one, a summer, and a winter two, this would allocate the states similar to how SCUP is modeled, using state-by-state quotas in conjunction with coast-wide measures. So 2D1, because Maryland has an IFQ program in place, they would be exempt from this first option. So as you can see here, their quota would not be included during this summer period, and they would be exempt from the coast-wide measures to keep intact their IFQ program. And the second option is to include them in the summer period and subject them to the coastwide and the state-by-state measures during the summer period. So the summer quotas that you see here are based on 1997 to 2016 landings, and this would most likely create a derby-style fishery for boats that are farther away from fishing grounds. So because they're constrained to this time period, they would have to rush out to the fishing grounds farther away from their home port. So most states aren't a fan of this option.
What about New Jersey?
Whether they're a fan or not?
Well, I see they have the biggest. Excuse me, Jeff. May I talk? May I ask a question? I see they have the biggest quota on this particular option here. Is there a possibility that they could throw all of this work overboard again, or cause all of this to be thrown overboard again?
New Jersey, in this case.
That's just the summer time part of the entire year. So there are three periods. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Couple of questions, if I may. Are we catching anywhere near our quota in Virginia?
Yes.
And is North Carolina for summer flounder really bigger than we are, or was it back in the 70s or 80s? I thought they were mostly southern flounder.
Well, they have southern flounder. They have three species of flounder, but Mead may have some outlook on that, on how they did in the past.
They landed more summer flounder than Virginia did from, was it 80 through 89, when they, you know, that's where they based all these numbers for all these states.
And before the regulation.
That's the only fish that we have down here in Virginia and Carolina. I mean, that's what everybody did in the winter. The trawlers fish for summer flounder in the winter, and then they'd go shrimping in the summer. And one reason you never heard any of this before now is the New England states had other fish to catch. They caught windowpane, gray sole, all these other ground fish up there.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't no ground fish left. They overfished things. They mismanaged things. And Virginia and North Carolina, with the lion's share of this quota, has done a great job managing what they have. And they built the value of this fishery up by not overlapping their quotas and working together. And and now we have a very valuable fishery in New York. Now all of a sudden wants it. Well, they didn't complain about this for the first 15 years of this.
They're seeing more fish now too, though, right?
You know, this shift is not really a shift. You've proven it's an expansion of the stock. It's not a shift north. It's just a
shift in effort.
Yeah. I mean, the Virginia and Carolina trawl fleet has always fished up in that area. We used to fish some down here off Virginia when you could catch small flounder and medium flounder, and that's what all the cutting houses in Virginia and Carolina cut for years and years. But with the TED line, the turtle excluding devices, and the value in the fish, the bigger fish, whole fish, there's more effort north now. So.
All right. Thank you.
As long as I can remember, I've shoveled a lot of flounder when I was younger. The trawlers coming in before they ever had any of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the fish they caught in the winter come off of New York.
Mm-hmm.
Second thing was the closest place they could come
in. And New York had some good landings, but they didn't report it. They sold it for cash. And it, you know, for the first 10 or 12, 15, and everybody knows that. And for the first 10 or 12, 15 years of this quota, they didn't care because they were catching so much other fish, and they were still, and they probably still are, selling fish for cash up there.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, they want a part of it.
I think it is
the whole thing is disgusting. But
shifting the years like this?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't this highly unusual, want to change the years to see? Just like us, for example, if striped bass, if we went back one more year when they'd done 75 to 79, if we went back one more year, our ocean quota would have doubled. That's all it would have took, 1 year. We would have had twice as much.
Shifting the years, they can't, because what happened, whatever happened in 1993 when they set the system up with allocation, then that just carried forward. So there's not a choice to say, well, hey, let's try a period in the 90s or the 2000s. It would end up pretty much the same thing, because the states continued to take their quotas. So that's why they come up with different ways, such as the biomass.
That's exactly right.
Which maybe is a way forward, is this idea that once you get to a certain level of quota, not 8.4, not 10.71, maybe 10.71 in the near future, that once you get above that quota, then states can get pretty much an equal share, rather than going back to the percentages that they have in allocation. We would not get any more than we get, but at least it's something that might be a way forward. And, you know, so, you know, I don't correctly, the committee that reports to the Mid-Atlantic Council said, we want to stay status quo. And they voted on it, and it was like, you know, by four votes, I think, or three votes, to stay status quo. This was back last year. And then at the council, brought in the ASMSC and the council together, like they do for these issues, and there was a lot of pressure not to go just status quo, because there's a lot of investment in this, I guess. I mean, I'm not being facetious. There's a lot of investment in this, and a lot of time spent, 3 years so far, and people want some resolution. They want a resolution. So, you know, I'm hoping that this idea of get to a certain level of quota back the way it used to be, and then give some fair allocation to all the states. Of course, the problem is, even if you do that, what Sydney has, New York only goes from 5.6% up to 10-point-something%. And they want to be like Rhode Island. They want to be up at 15%. And yes, New York has been pushing for 2 years straight on this. Court injunctions, whatever you call them, court orders. I mean, the meetings, it gets kind of uncomfortable to listen to all that. And what Mead is saying, a New Yorker told me, they want their cake and eat it too. When they had the fish, when they made the catch, many of them did not report. So, you know, it's really been the last 3 years working with this. Not, you know, you're going to have people really bent out of shape one way or the other.
So New York wants the fish they didn't report counted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, historically.
In essence, that's what they're saying.
Yeah.
But, okay. You know, when this happened in the beginning, Connecticut had a chance, and they Connecticut said, we don't like these numbers. They're not right. And they went back and adjusted them, and Connecticut got a little boost. It was 5 years into this program, 4 years into it. So New York had opportunity for years and years to do this. But it wasn't valuable then. The other thing is Virginia, North Carolina, all these other states have reduced the number of boats and licenses in the fishery able to land. And New York has never, not until this year, have they even started to make a move to reduce the number of permits. There are 500, roughly 450 to 500 permits available in New York. So if they get a little increase in quota, it's not going to amount to any landings per fisherman because of all the different licenses. It's just they've never managed their fishery very well, and now they want more. It's pretty bad. And they're threatening lawsuits. And if it goes, status quo will not happen because of that, because they're threatening lawsuits. And nobody wants to have to deal with that. It's just horrible. It's everything that's wrong with this process.
Yeah. But it's nothing. It's not limited to commercial. They've been doing it to the recreational fishermen. We're just not, you know, seeing it now. But y'all have been taking it on the chin since, you know, 99, 98. You know, they've overfished every year, and they rearrange the numbers and, you know, never get penalized on the recreational side. So now it's, you know, coming in our direction, and, you know, Connecticut, weren't they de minimis in recreational at one time? And now, and then, so wasn't Connecticut?
Really, the recreational fishery the last 6 or 7 years has stayed within the, I'll call it quota, except for 1 year. But prior to that,
it was grotesque.
You know, there were overages, and the regional administrator did tell everyone, I'm going to put you all on coastwide, which meant that we have the same problems.
And I'm not trying to mix apples and oranges. I'm just saying we need to work together. You know, I've said that all along. I've been saying that for 15, 20 years. You know, we can keep taking it, you know, from these people. And, you know, it's just...
I think the problem we have here is this is the same bunch with the striped bass. It's going to be the seven states against the South. And basically that's where we're at.
Tom, you had a question?
Yeah, so... Now, MRIP says fundamentally we're catching twice as many recreational flounder over all these years. And this fishery, I think, is split 60% commercial, 40% recreational.
Right.
When are they going to address that?
It's going to come up again soon.
You're not supposed to base it on economics. It's based on basis years from whenever, but whenever those years were, it was determined it was 60% commercial, 40% recreational.
Some of the recent things going on are to look at economic impacts, and when the council gets involved under NIMS, they have to look at economic impacts. So there's a document right now of 250 pages, an EIS, environmental impact statement, that I don't think is completely finalized, but that goes along. When you're the federal system, that's what you have to do. An economic impact report. Mead is right. It's been a really tortuous few years here, and it keeps on biting.
Two last issues really quickly.
All right, thank
Third
you.
Issue is to add landing flexibility to the framework so that the council can do this through a framework action rather than an amendment process. So 3A is no action, and 3B is to add the landing flexibility into the council's FMP. And this would eliminate the advantage that multi-state permits have. So in Virginia, we have people from New Jersey that can land here, and also I believe we added North Carolina. So we have other states that land in Virginia, and that is counted towards our landing. Yeah. So this landing flexibility would allow anybody to land in the state that they choose. So. And then we have the last alternative, which is 4. This basically just revises the FMP objectives. So here are the current objectives: reduce fishing mortality, improving the yield, and minimizing regulations. So this alternative really just rearranges things into goals and objectives. So we already have objectives 4 that are under goals. So the goals would be broader picture, umbrella issues, and then the objectives that are already in the FMP would fall under these goals. So on Wednesday night, we have our Virginia public hearing. Kirby from the ASMSC will be here to once again present all of this and go into further detail. However, the ASMSC is accepting written comments until October 12th. And then the council and board will take final action in December. So we really need people to speak up and advocate for our state as much as possible.
Yeah, didn't know anything about the COVID.
If we go back to the landing flexibility question for a minute. Right now, people that are licensed in other states can land in Virginia. They have our permit. And if we changed it, they could land anywhere.
Permits
and
would not be a value that position. I think some of the proponents of land flexibility have realized that because they're the ones who have purchased various state permits. Virginia land flexibility is no value to the permit. But the real problem with land flexibility, in my opinion, land flexibility in a scut model is you turn the fishery into a derby. So boats in the north get to the fish, you have folks from Carolina and Virginia getting up there. By the time they return, because of the dedication to return to the state, at least the Virginia and North Carolina boats, that, you're disadvantaged, it would be a disaster.
Well, with the flexibility, they can land anywhere, but whose state does that get accounted for?
Well, that's the rub. Yeah. It would be a disaster.
Still count towards Virginia.
And most people know that you couldn't keep track of the numbers very well that way.
Law enforcement's not looking
kindly at it. Most people involved in this commercial allocation issue right now, a couple things. The latent permits was 900 and some. If you don't have a state permit, your federal permit isn't worth anything. So, states like New York need to deal with latent permits. Virginia and Carolina, the other states already have. As far as the federal permit is concerned, it's a moot point, really. And then landing flexibility, most people that are in the fishery or involved in the fishery and have different state licenses realize that's a disaster. we work with other states and allow some flexibility already, transient with other states' fish on and landing under certain circumstances in other states. And then, like you said, law enforcement thinks this, and keeping the landings, keeping track of the landings would be a disaster. You've already got some states that have proven with the research set aside that, you know, you have, you leave it open for a lot of fraud if you do that. So hopefully those issues are going to get taken care of because of those, what I just said. A lot of people involved in this look at it that way, I think. The main thing is, and what this whole thing has been about from the beginning, is New York and somewhat Massachusetts want some of Virginia and Carolina's quota. That's the whole issue here.
So with flexibility, they could fish off New Jersey, land in New Jersey, and count it towards Virginia? Is that correct?
No, it'll still come off New Jersey.
Where they land, it would be counted
where
towards
the fish
their
come
land.
Shore, that's it. That's the landing point. That's the boat. The other thing, though, which maybe you're familiar with, is about 4 years ago, the council assistant regional administrator, George Darcy, you know George, mm-hmm. he was asked could there be a trucking operation. So that's also come up, you know, over the last 3 years with that. But you come in, you land your fish in Jersey or New York wherever, but you truck them to Carolina or Virginia. And they would have to do some changes in the law to make that happen. But that's one of the other things we've been proposed. And, you know, it's
never gotten very far, though.
Yeah.
Everybody sees that as a disaster.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We'll miss you.
Thank you. Well, I have two more presentations.
All right.
I'm not done yet.
I wasn't trying to rush you to leave.
I like it.
Okay. So going into our third agenda item, C, the ASMSC had an August meeting. I'm going to give you the update for several species. So summer flounder. The ASMSC has been discussing recreational management options for 2019 season and beyond. The options that were discussed at this meeting included setting measures through specifications process, using conservation equivalency, and working with the provisions of the fishery management plan. The board chose to initiate an addendum, which I'll explain in further detail, which is through a working group process. And this includes both black sea bass and summer flounder. And the working group spoke this month, which Chief O'Reilly is on, and the states expressed that their interest is in regional management. So for black sea bass, similar issues. So the staff gave a brief presentation on the strategic plan that was used to replace Addendum 30, which was appealed in March. We currently have an interim system right now, and moving forward, they'll need to consider Addendum 32, which is that recreational management addendum, including black sea bass and summer flounder. The operational assessment is set for early 2019, which will incorporate those new MRIP numbers. And this will then affect how our recreational measures are instituted. So we currently have a RHL, but in the near future it will have to be changed to reflect this new number. So the management options include coastwide measures, state by state, regional, and setting measures through a specifications process. During a work group call a few weeks ago, the states expressed that they have interest in remaining status quo until those new MRIP estimates and the assessment results are final, which we believe will happen in mid-2019. So the draft addendum 31, which is on conservation equivalency, Block Island Sound transit and slot limits, considers options that would allow the black sea bass federal waters measures to be waived in favor of state regulations where the anglers land their catch. This addresses the disproportionate impacts of coastwide measures. And the council's framework would have slot limit alternatives that would be able for the board and council to use. And that's still in the process, so I'm not going to go too far into that. And then draft addendum 32, which is the recreational management options that I was speaking about, include the status quo, which is coastwide or conservation equivalency measures, or the specifications process. This addendum aims to establish an interim management approach for 2019 that would allow for more equitable regional allocations and addressing the management measures in a more responsive way that reflects the distribution of the stock. So ASMSB would like to know if Virginia has interest in having a combined public hearing for both of these addenda, so 31 and 32. And so they would come and they would go through each addendum and have public comment periods. How do we feel about that?
Definitely.
Well, we should. I think we're going to be left out some of the information.
We're going to be left out anyway, Rob.
Even if we can't get a fairly good turnout, and still, I think that we do need to have a good turnout.
Yes, sir. And this, from what I say, this is basically the recreational option of the commercial option we just discussed, taking quota away from us and giving it to New York and New Jersey for the go-overall time on the flounder issue,
this is
making it more equitable.
Black sea bass and summer flounder, and it's a very unusual time right now because of these new EMRIT estimates. So try and follow this. I struggle with it. They're going to take summer flounder, and we don't know where it goes. But in the meantime, as Sydney said, the working group has at least proposed to the management board, let's not do anything. Let's stay where we are until the dust settles and we know what comes out of everything for summer flounder. That may be May or June by the time the National Marine Fisheries Service writes a rule. So we're waiting on that. The second part is black sea bass. What they're going to do on the recreational black sea bass is they're going to calibrate the new MRIT back to the old MRIT because they're not doing a benchmark assessment, they're just doing an update. So they're going to do an updated assessment pretending as if there's no new MRIT, it's all old MRIT, and then sometime in the future when they can fit it in, they're going to do a black sea bass benchmark assessment. So it's really unusual. This about should there be a public hearing is because ASMFC does not have enough substantive information to say what direction things are going. All they can tell the public is here's some things that addendum 31 and 32 could provide as we go forward. It's pretty unusual. So it's but no. That's not what it's all about, to shift around different quota. It's all about the uncertainty, and this is the most uncertainty that we've ever seen at the ASMSC and the council waiting for these new approaches for summer flounder and striped bass, and then somehow using this old EMRIT estimates in an assessment for black sea bass and back to calibrating. Everyone's unsettled, at least that I talked to. They don't know what to expect. In the meantime, I think having a hearing, we at least get the information coming from ASMSC on these two approaches that they're doing here. So things are changing.
Remember a few years ago, you know, they did that poor data stock assessment on black sea bass.
Yes,
I've never heard of such a thing as poor data stock assessment until that one.
So do you need from us a motion to approve these?
I'd just like some idea that you want to have a public hearing. That would be good enough. Even if there's a couple of people, few people on the committee, if you think a public hearing is good information.
Yes, I do.
Agreed.
I think
agreed.
It'd be good to have a public hearing, absolutely. And by combining the two species, you might actually get...
You might actually get more people turnout, plus they'll hear from us.
Hey, we have a quorum now, correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, so somebody make a motion to...
So moved.
Recommend joint public hearing on options 31 and 32.
Okay, we have a first, we have a second. All right, we have it. All in favor? Raise your hand.
Good. Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That leaves none opposed. Do you oppose? Did you raise your hand?
No.
Did you raise your hand?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
I'm not coming. You're going to be my proxy.
Okay. So one more presentation, and then I'm finished. So at the Mid-Atlantic August meeting, the commercial quotas and the RHLs were approved for summer flounder, scup, and black sea bass. So for summer flounder, the 2019 commercial quota will be 7.72 million pounds, which is a 16% increase from 2018. The RHL recreational harvest limit will be 5.15 million pounds, which is also a 16% increase from 2018. Scup will be 23.98 million pounds, which was already approved in August of 2017, so they're remaining the same from 2018 to 2019, as well with the recreational harvest limit at 7.37 million pounds. And black sea bass is decreasing slightly from 3.52 million pounds to 3.14 million pounds, and 3.66 to 3.27 million pounds. However, this is interim. Because of these new MRF estimates, they'll have to circle back around, and once the new stock assessments come out and the new estimates come out, they'll have to revisit this and reset the recreational harvest limits accordingly. And this will most likely affect the commercial quotas.
So, just for information, what happens is there's been this either 2 or 3 year approach to setting quotas and recreational harvest limits. For summer flounder, everyone is a little bit gun shy about what was set back in 2016 for 2019, whether that's realistic, whether it should have increased like that. But the scientific committee, statistical and scientific committee of the council said, we don't have information to know whether that should be changed or not. So in the meantime, staying status quo means it's going to be in mid-2019 when measures might be changed compared to staying status quo in the interim. Black sea bass, on the other hand, is entirely different. Black sea bass, the latest information did not consider the 2015 year class, which is not as strong as the 2011 year class, which was a monster year class, but which is a very good year class, both in the northern and southern regions. But that wasn't part of the assessment update that they did at the time. And so staying status quo there is a lot easier because everyone is thinking that black sea bass, unlike summer flounder, was about 2.3 times higher in its biomass than it needed to be when they finally did a decent assessment. And so there'll be a change there too in mid-season as well. So there are different reasons why, if you just look at the numbers, they're not telling you exactly what's going on about those numbers and why they're there. Scott, scup's a different story. Scup's off the roof, too. Scup has had tremendous biomass. We don't see much scup. We see some on the commercial end of it, not a lot. And with scup, the reason that the quotas and the recreational haven't really jumped up even more is because there's this scientific uncertainty coming out of the approach that comes through the council. And with the council, even though there's joint plans, once the council sets its acceptable biological catch, its ABC, that's it. That's the ceiling. You can't go higher than that. That started in 2008. So, you know, if you get a chance, I know the Virginia Beach meeting was fairly recent. That wasn't too long ago. But if you get a chance next time around, look at the website from Mid-Atlantic Council. And if you haven't been to a council meeting, for example, it's different than the ASMSC. I mean, it definitely is different.
So we went over most of the rest of this, but I have some numbers, the new MRF numbers. So if we look at Virginia in the yellow, in 2016 we are estimated at 211,000 fish. So this first table is a number of fish, and we've been decreasing. However, we remain the highest harvester in our region. So the numbers on the side, out of Delaware, Maryland, and Virginia, we are the highest harvester. And then this is the same, and this is by weight. This is the same with pounds. So the, as you can see, estimates are much larger than what the recreational harvest limits have been, just because they're based on the new MRF numbers. And so already in 2018, there's been 2 million pounds harvested. So that'll have to come into play when redoing the recreational harvest totals. And then for black seabass.
No, didn't appear that way.
So we're back to the same question. If it's supposed to be a 40-60 split, and now the numbers for recreational harvest are way more than they were when they set that split, is recreational harvest going to have to get cut by a factor of two? So that we still get the 40-60 split, or is it going to be the recreational harvest, the split is going to change? I mean, we have different data now.
This is what we call probably to be determined, because no one has the output yet to look at. I think Jeff said it correctly before when he said that everything's going to change. The size will change, the biological reference point will change. And, you know, I am at EMRC. I am right in the middle. I'm about as neutral as anyone you'll find, and my staff the same way. It's hard for us to forget that kind of information, but I will tell you this. We have to look at what I heard tonight, which was, if the stock size is bigger, then both commercial quotas were too small and the recreational harvest was too small. I mean, that's the way I'm looking at it. I just don't know how this looks once they...
But, no, well, the way I would look at it is that the recreational harvest was underestimated, and that the limit was, if it's a factor of two times higher in reality, because that's what we were harvesting based on. But then the commercial quota, I agree with Ernie, is probably a very accurate number, at least to the 10-15% level of what they're actually harvesting. And so now you're talking about, well, we have to change all the numbers. No, the commercial fishermen have been harvesting based on what they did years ago, the same amount as we go up, and we have been underestimating the recreational harvest all along, as well as the quota that is attached to it, because we're just doing the quotas and the models based on what we think we're harvesting, plus some other data, but mostly based on harvest.
I want to say that sort of, I understand what you're saying, but I think it's much more complex than that.
No doubt, but...
Because of the quota system. system that is based on two opposite types of surveys, almost effort and catch, and putting them together. It's very hard to do. I asked, the only question I asked Dave Van Voorhees from NIMS, because they did the new dog and pony show a couple times on the new Emirate, and what I was really interested in, so does National Marine Fisheries Service say that we can manage quotas with recreational bait? Now, I didn't get a terrific answer to that, but, you know, if you go back, National Marine Fisheries Service always said, we don't think our data should be used to manage quotas. And lo and behold,
we always
the management did. System made quotas out of recreational bait. And the most ridiculous one of all was what we did it with striped bass in the bay. And we said, well, we'll manage our commercial and recreational striped bass fishery by quota. And we never got our quota estimate until February of the following year. So what type of real-time management was that? It's something to probably have a cup of cappuccino and talk about, Tom.
Okay.
I missed something there, though. You said it was we were the largest in those amounts. Is that what you said? That our numbers were the highest? You mean in our
region?
In the region. Okay.
Now we're in Delmarva region.
Okay, in Delmarva region. I got you. Okay. I got you.
I'm not going to say even more. The Black Sea Bass is kind of the same picture. So we aren't the highest in our Delmarva region for Black Sea Bass, and we're pretty low on the totem pole in this recreational number of fish as well as pounds. But as you can see, the numbers have exploded quite a bit. And that's all I got.
All right, thank you very much.
So they're going to continue with the ASMSC update for other species.
That's it, I think, first, Joe.
I mean, perspective is everything. I remember sweating bullets over an 800,000 summer flounder recreational target. And yeah, we were going over 600,000, 700,000. So now with the new MRIP, Sydney showed you that we're doing like 200,000 fish, something like that. But with the old MRIP, which is much more conservative, we were just, you know, had unbelievable harvest. So, you know, you have to keep all that in mind, too, when you look at a new data set. And everyone's struggling with this. I mean, I guarantee you everyone's struggling with this. What ASMFC has done, and I said they're different. Some of you I know I've seen at ASMFC, so you know how it goes. It goes species, 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 species. And that's it. I mean, that's 3 days worth. Mid-Atlantic Council might have deep-sea corals in there. It might have boehm stuff on wind energy in there. It has species, species, but it's entirely different. Well, the ASMFC, I think, is very bright too, the ASMFC leadership, because they developed, and you heard Sydney mention it, these work groups. The first work group was eel, American eel, and I was on that work group. It lasted about 2 years, or seemed like it. So the work group is good because ASMFC must have decided, they must have had like a closed door meeting and decided, look, we're taking all the heat for what we do. We're working up all these products. We're getting out to the states. The states are unhappy. And, you know, one thing after another, how do we get over that? And they must have said, let's have work groups, because if we have work groups, it's going to consist of state reps as well as technical people. And that way, by the time you get to the management board and the work group has made its recommendations, if there's any heat, it's shared. So I think it's brilliant, quite frankly. I mean, I think it's a concerted effort by ASMFC, and the work groups are proliferating. So one was eel. The eel one lasted a while, and this is on the commercial end. And Addendum 5, was finalized in August. And what it did was there had been this idea that there could be state-specific quotas going in. Then it was found out that, you know, I knew we didn't have it. Other states knew that they didn't have the right data. They weren't using the right data. I mean, they were off quite a bit, you know, 10, 20,000 pounds a year. And it was just because of the way that ASMSC previously gained data, they just asked the state representative, the technical committee, to send them the data. Well, with ACCSP, which you've heard about, Atlantic Coastal Cooperative Statistics Program, and their warehouse, all that has changed now. So they get the right data. It took a while. They got the right data on eel. The decision was not to have state-specific quotas, but instead to keep the coastwide quota they had, which is like 916,473 pounds. And my brilliant addition to that process was convincing people that you don't want to have like a knife-edge approach here where if you go over by a pound that all of a sudden everyone gets pushed into regulations. Why don't you take 2 years, and if the coastwide quota is breached 2 years by 10% or more, then there's action. But now the action isn't going to be on all the states. It's going to be on the states that had the over-harvest, and it's going to be up to them to get together and work out a solution to bring the harvest back down to the coastwide cap. So I thought that was pretty neat the way it ended. It was unbelievable. There had to have been at least 8 conference calls with the work group, but you know that's the way things are going with the ASMSC. The second species that I want to talk about most has already been talked about. Atlantic striped bass. I think the important thing to tell you is until we get through, we all of us get through this assessment and know what we face, pretty much everything's been just sort of put on hold. The last action was when they allowed Maryland to drop an inch in size, although I had to leave before that issue was finalized, and my understanding was it wasn't very comfortable for Maryland because they didn't quite dot the I's and cross the T's as they said they would with their proposal. So I'm sure that the only thing I heard from that is Maryland has to come back with more justification about their plan. And I'm just in the grassroots sometimes too, but all I heard was that in the 11th hour, the charter boat called the governor, Governor Hogan, and said, look, you know, we can't really do these offset circle hooks and everything else like that, and you know, it's not going to work out. And it's gotten quiet after that. And I haven't really pinpointed my Maryland fellow to say, well, what really went on there. But I think that, you know, the ASMSC will make sure that you do your due diligence. So they will be following up on that. The assessment's underway. One of two, as I mentioned, when there's something that we can share, we'll share it so Jeff can distribute it, and then we'll have a follow-up. I apologize that we have this kind of a meeting because it's an informational meeting, but I think it's important information. We're not really trying to solve problems and, you know, get issues, you know, put where they belong sometimes, which is on the back shelf. So your interaction is very important to staff, and I realize tonight that this is more of an informational approach, and I really thank everyone who came out tonight. I looked out my window a few times earlier, and it was really raining. Of course, it's been raining since July, so what's new?
Yeah.
But so thank you, and I think Pat has a few things to say.
Okay.
Hi, thank you very much for having me. I'm going to talk about the ASMSC South Atlantic State Federal Board that I've had the honor of serving two states for now, and I have the dubious honor of being the chairman for a total of 4 years. So I'm the chairman of the South Atlantic Board for the commission, so I'm dealing with the cobia and croaker and spot issues quite a bit. So First thing is cobia. Obviously, most of you already know that it's presently under transition with NOAA Fisheries, Fisheries and South Atlantic Fisheries Management Council. It's going to be going to Atlantic Sanctuary Marine Fisheries Commission. ASMFC will be the sole management agency for cobia eventually, probably by 2020.
Why did that change, out of curiosity?
Why did that change? Because about 84% of the harvest occurs in state waters.
Okay.
So the council came to the commission and said, let's do complementary during the whole process. Some people saying, hey, you know, we've done that for flounder, it doesn't work out that great, you may want to consider it another way. And the commission decided that, you know, if NIMS wants to give it up, the commission will take it on as a managed species. So right now, in June, South Atlantic Marine Fisheries Commission and the Gulf of Mexico Fisheries Management Council both approved taking it out of their Coastal Migratory Pelagic Resources FMPs. So it's in the process of getting out of federal. It's sitting with the Secretary of Commerce waiting to be approved. ASMFC is presently, as a result, putting forward an Addendum 1 for the management plan. We've got a public information document, which is presently out for Amendment 1. We had a meeting here last week, and we had two people show up. So, what, you didn't hear about it?
Nope.
We put out notice to a whole lot of people, and so we apologize you didn't hear.
I don't honestly. I think
it must not have just been me, though. I mean, if two people showed up,
it's not uncommon.
What we said about
We were a little surprised to have that few. We expected more, but we were a little surprised to have two. But it's
is that on the same email list for these meetings or not?
Say again.
It's not on the same list for these meetings.
No, it's not.
So there's no cross pollination there.
I mean,
or some email groups.
That's true. We sent it out to all of our recreational and commercial permit holders.
Recreational what?
As well.
You sent it out to commercial hook and line holders? You say commercial permit holders. How did you send it out to commercial hook and line holders?
I believe through email.
How did, nobody puts their email on when they buy their hook and line license. They're not required to. I'm not going on the attack. It's just frustrating.
I know it is.
Okay, please, I'm being respectful of you. I'm very familiar with commercial hook and line. You know, when we buy our license, we're not required to give an email. I don't know. Anyway, keep going.
I think the best thing I've heard is we can go to Jeff and he can disseminate any kind of news.
Yep.
I don't think we did that. We did put on the website, but hey, if you're like me, sometimes I don't mean my own website, but I can't navigate websites that easily either. So, but we will do that with Jeff and make sure it gets everything.
We'll just send the emails out if there's something, I would say.
The other thing is to get on the ASMFC email list because I got 4 emails about that meeting from them, from Tina.
It's a public information document. They were trying to get as much information as possible of how people want the fishery managed. Because of the storm, they changed the comment dates. Comments are not due until October 10th now. I'll give you guys the address if you want it. I'll give it to you. I can give you guys copies of the PID document as well. The priority issues are looking at recommendations for management in federal waters. How do they want the waters managed? They want it to be wherever you land in that state, you follow those regulations. Do they want to extend the state boundaries out into federal waters? Or do they want to have a single federal regulation coastwide? These are just options. It's whatever option people can think of. They're also considering harvest specifications and allowing quick turnaround because there's a stock assessment that will be coming up as well that's going to occur approximately September of about the same time this amendment is finishing. So they want to have a way that they can work on things very quickly, how to deal with allocations if that's necessary, things like that. And the other item is biological monitoring. What biological monitoring would be required? Virginia is well ahead of the game in that. We're going to be like the poster child. We have a very good freezer program that collects close to 1,000 cobia per year, so we get age and length in all those animals, so we're well ahead of that game as far as the other states are concerned. And the people at the meeting said they'd rather have it be voluntary than be mandatory. The timeline for it, we just had the public hearing for the public information document. The board will hear the information that came from that in October at the annual meeting. And from there, they'll give some direction on the amendment, the draft amendment. The amendment will be prepared between October and May of next year. Will be reviewed in the May meeting, and it will go out for public comment from May through August of next year. And the board will have a public comment in August of 2019, and will be reviewed and approved by August of 2019. And as I said, the stock assessment is being done through CDAR 58, and that's due out in September of 2019. And yes, I'm sure they'll be using the new MRF data on that. That's all I have on COVID. Do you have any questions on COVID before we move on to Croker and Spot? And I sincerely apologize if anybody did not get the emails and notice about that. We'll try to do a better job. I mean, you know, we're trying to reach as many people as possible with these meetings. We don't want to come to a meeting with two people. We don't want the commission to come down here. We've had plenty of meetings where nobody shows up. We had a public hearing on yields a few months ago.
And nobody showed up, right?
Nobody showed up.
I'm surprised COBIA, as popular as they are, I'm surprised.
We were too. We were too.
I mean, every boat longer than 10 feet has a tower on it.
Yes.
Including some that aren't 10 feet.
When does the comment period close on the COBIA PFT?
October 10th. And I'll get you that information before we leave tonight. I think I have a copy of it I can distribute to you all.
Well, send it to me and I'll pass it on to my list.
All right, nothing else on COBIA?
Guess not.
Croker, Tom Savitz, subject. Croker is presently managed through a traffic light analysis approach, and the way this works is these are the ugliest graphs in the world. They kind of make you mind, you know, get blurry, but the way they're designed is it looks at the long-term average, and if you see increasing red, things are getting worse. If you see increasing green, things are getting better, in a sense. And it's based on two metrics. It's based on a harvest metric, which is MREP and commercial landings, and it's based on an abundance metric, which is done by the Northeast Fisheries Fisheries Center's Groundfish Survey and the CMAP Survey, which is the Southeast, sort of the equivalent of the Northeast Fisheries Trawl Survey. And as you can see for Croker is on the left. You can see the top one is the commercial and harvest, recreational harvest, and we're seeing increasing red. Right now, they're using this 30 percentile as anything above that is of concern. If it goes over 60%, it's very high concern. And then in Croker, you're seeing not quite the same kind of trend, but you can see it's, you know, not as bad as it was. And the problem we're having is both these, the abundance metric and the harvest metric, by the policy of the management FMPs that they have to agree or no action is taken. So commercially, we're seeing things look bad, but the surveys are not seeing that. The surveys have, you know, quite a bit of green in those, as you can see. So they're not seeing the same thing, so no management action has been taken at this point.
Are the surveys, do they have data that is fine enough where you can look at harvestable size?
These are only adults.
Okay.
These are only adults.
And adults is defined as for Croker?
I'd have to look at and see exactly what size they're. They're age 1 plus.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, A9. So it's and that's the problem they've been having. We've had numerous discussions at several board meetings about what to do with this. The TC has been concerned about this, so the board tasked the TC for looking at other methods of how else we can do this. And so what they came up with was, show you the present right now, it's coastwide. They manage coastwide, and that's what those graphics were. And like I said, the harvest metric was commercial landings and the MRF data. The adult abundance metric is coming from two trawl surveys, one in out of Woods Hole and one out of Charleston. But what they were proposing is regional management, the South being Florida and North Carolina, and the Mid-Atlantic being from Virginia northward, adding new surveys to it as well. Chess map, which is done by VIMS for the Mid-Atlantic, and the North Carolina Department of Marine Fisheries, the Pamlico Sound Survey, which has been done since the 1980s. They want to keep the trigger mechanisms, which are 30%, which is a moderate and the 60% red metrics. But instead of having it be for Croker right now, it's, you have to have three consecutive years in a row to trigger one of, to trigger a response. They want it to be 2 out of 3 years for both Spot and Croker. This is what they recommended. They came to the board and discussed this several times, and these are the results we came up with. The latest results through 2017 show that in the South, the harvest trigger, it's triggered 2 of the last 3 years at that 30 percentile that I talked about, and the abundance is not triggered for Spot. In the Mid-Atlantic, both metrics have triggered over the past 3 years. Okay, with these new methods. And with Atlantic Croker in the South, the harvest has been above that trigger for the 30% trigger for the last 6 years, but abundance has not. And Mid-Atlantic for Croker, harvest has been above for the 7 consecutive years and 2 years above the 60 percentile, which is considered an elevated level of concern. And the abundance has been above that trigger for the last 8 years. So there's more of a concern in the Mid-Atlantic than there is in the South Atlantic at this point. An addendum was proposed. Let me go back. An addendum was proposed back in the May meeting to go ahead and adopt these traffic light approaches, these new traffic light approaches and this new data, which is required of the addendum, and to start drafting some kind of management action. It was tabled at the May meeting. It got brought up again at the August meeting that we just had recently. And some of the states felt that an addendum is not the way to move forward with something of this magnitude. It should be an amendment. So the vote that was tabled was turned down in lieu of having the states go back to their stakeholders and find out what kind of management do you want to see for these species. Instead of the technical committee and the board deciding those things through an addendum or an amendment, go back to the states. What would you prefer to have? Would you like to have size limits or mesh size restrictions or krill limits or harvest limits or seasons? What's required for these, you know, for these species? So we're in the process of looking at these. We're going to be having a scoping meeting sometime in the next few months and report back to the commission by February is the plan at this point. So and just I got a bunch of other graphs to show you real quick, but this is just the Mid-Atlantic, and you can see that black line, the harvest and the abundance of Spot. You can see the last 2 of the last 3 years were above that trigger, and we've had 4 years for the abundances that have been above that trigger, so a management response based on the present fisheries management plan for these species would require a management action. And in the South, which we really don't care about because we're not in this area, but it hasn't. It's triggered in 2017 with a 2 year, two to three previous years, but the abundance estimates have not, and that seems to be a trend. We seem to be seeing that the independent trawl surveys are not showing a problem that we're seeing in the commercial fisheries. And then again with Croker. We're seeing in the Mid-Atlantic 7 straight years above the 30 percentile and 2 years above that 60 percentile. And the abundance, yes, we're seeing 8 years in a row above that 30 percentile, and we would have a management action expected based on the management plan as we have it now. And the South, again, it's triggered for the 6 straight years, the harvest metric, and the abundance is not. And I just mentioned this. I just already mentioned this. There was a motion. It was postponed. It was defeated in August. And I mentioned the possible management actions that could take place. This is what our landings are looking like now. This is through 2017 for Virginia. You know, we're seeing declining effort, and we're just seeing declining catches as well.
Is that commercial recreational?
This is commercial.
Okay.
Just commercial. And
that's overall all catch types.
All gears. Yeah. So it's open at this point. And we're going to have a meeting about this to discuss what's palatable to the users groups. What would be best? Some states feel that a size limit. A few states have said size limits, and most people go, I don't know if the size limit's going to work on Croker, per se. It might work in the recreational, but certainly isn't going to work commercially. I don't think. A lot of states have considered maybe doing some kind of seasonal effort, but the technical committee was providing all this information and was hoping the board would come back and say, do this, do that, and do this. And there was nobody willing to come forward and do those things with at least not talking to their stakeholders first. It seems to be more of a problem in the Mid-Atlantic. I can tell you I just came here from Georgia 6 months ago, and they're saying don't do a thing. They're fine with it right now. They don't, you know, so it's true. I mean, Delaware has expressed concerns. Potomac River Fisheries Commission, Maryland has expressed a very strong concern for spot. And, you know, we've heard the reports about croaker, not seeing any croaker out there recreationally and commercially. So we're moving.
If you look at MRIP, we had spectacular harvest in March and May, or April and May. I mean, is this where it's, what's going on?
I'm not talking MRIP right now, so.
I'm not either. I mean, or I am, but.
we've heard it from too many people. Too many people that the landings of croaker and spot, you know.
It's horrible.
I mean, that's exactly the word we've been hearing from people. We've heard some reports recently of some good catches, but overall, it's down, and it's down significantly. And for croaker, you know, especially for croaker, they're cyclic. They're going to come up and up and down. They're going to have those kind of cycles. But the issue is, if you're fishing it, if you continue to fish it when it's at a low end, are you going to cause even more harm to it?
So one question, can we do something to harvest the spiny dogfish that are sitting at the mouth of the bay every winter, just eating every fish that leaves on the bottom and heads out to the ocean?
Ecosystem-based management, man.
If you could get a graph.
That's apex predators.
If you could get a graph of the North Carolina shrimp catch and superimpose it over that, you can see when the shrimp catch is way up, spot and croaker are way down. They're shoveling them overboard all day long. You know, they probably, for every shrimp they catch, they kill 10 fish.
So one of the things they did do with the TC did with this new analysis, they looked at the shrimp bycatch. They're not using it in the traffic light approach right now. They're using it as a tuner index, so to speak. So they are looking at that. They're looking at the bycatch from those, especially from North Carolina.
Yeah. We've had a tremendous amount of shrimp in the Chesapeake Bay the last several years. When they leave, the fish are leaving the same time, the spot and croaker, they're right at the North Carolina line waiting for them. They had 90 baskets of shrimp one time, so you know they're not going to give it up. North Carolina is not going to do anything about it because they never had many spot landings. They had croaker landings on the inside, sands long hauling, which is similar to our haul lanes that they towed for 2 miles.
The reason why we have these traffic light approaches instead of a stock assessment, has biological reference points and is more, you know, this is a statistically sound method, but it doesn't have the rigors of a full stock assessment. Both the spot and the croaker failed primarily because they couldn't get a good handle on the shrimp bycatch. The peer review said they did a lot better job than they did in the last croaker assessment, but they still need to do more work on it. And so when people talk about doing another stock assessment on croaker, I personally don't see the point of doing it until they know they have a method to try to get a handle on that bycatch and put that into the equation somehow.
Okay.
That's what I have, and you know.
Just curious. You show the harvest of croakers in the downturn. What we've seen over the last few years, everybody fishes croakers in the bay with gill net or haul seines in the summer. They leave in the summer and they go down off of Carolina in the winter. If it's cold enough, they'll go below the capes. If not, they're above the capes. If they're above the capes, they're going to be trawled on. Those high harvest, those high years of harvest, there were a lot of trawl croakers landed in Virginia. Caught off North Carolina, brought up here and landed, and they couldn't get in Oregon Inlet, so they bring them up here and land them. And they were doing well. They were catching a lot, and they were good size then. Over the last 3 or 4 years, they've almost completely stopped trawling because they're so small. In a trawl net, you're going to catch smaller croakers, and they're not worth anything, and they've laid off of them on their own. I mean, the value's up because there's not as many croakers around, but they're small, and the trawl boats have really laid off of them. You haven't seen many landings of trawl croakers in the last few winters. So that's one of the reasons the harvest is down. And so they're fishing other things. You know, they're going to fish scup or other things instead of that. And so we're going to go put restrictions on it when they're voluntarily laying off of it because of size. And I mean, just is that being looked at? Is that being figured into this?
I see where you're coming with this because...
I mean, it's managing itself because the fish are getting smaller and smaller. We know the fishermen see that they're on a down cycle, and they're backing off of it in many cases. The hall seiners in the bay, when they get a really small set of croakers, they'll let them go because it's not worth bringing them in and killing them just for bait. So you're going to see the harvest go down for that reason. And those small fish will grow and get bigger, and this stock will rebound because of that.
I'm going to repeat a phrase that I've used a number of times. Landings are somewhat meaningless without effort.
Okay.
And it makes sense because, we're using just the landing zone here, and I said this to the TC several times. Has effort gone down? What has effort done? Sometimes you see effort is decreasing at a quicker rate than the landing zone. I mean, right now on those graphs, the effort is decreasing about the same rate. But the red line is effort.
Okay.
I agree. It's like if effort is going down, your landings are going to go down. I totally agree with that. And it's like, and that's why using a catch per unit effort is a better method of analyzing the data. And that's why, we're having this conflict, that the fisheries surveys, the scientific surveys, are not showing these trends as much overall.
Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut through.
Go ahead.
The surveys, I can't. They're doing NEMAPs in this, right?
Chess map is.
But NEMAP's not.
NEMAP is not because of its short time series. They're using it, but they're not using it overall. They will be using it when they get to long time series.
How far north are they using a Delaware Bay survey?
No, they're using the NIMS groundfish survey, which goes from Georges Banks down to Cape Hatteras.
Yeah, but it stays pretty far offshore, which for these species doesn't make a lot of sense.
And they're using the Southeast Monitoring and Assessment Program, which is a CMAP, which is equivalent to NEMAP. In the south, which goes from Cape Hatteras to Cape Canaveral, and they sample the same areas as NEMAP.
So one of the things we're seeing with these species, particularly spot too, is we're hearing of they're seeing spot further north than they ever have. Guys in Long Island catching spot, they've never caught them before. So, I mean, that's a big sample of fish now that's up there that's not where they traditionally were, that's not being sampled. So that has that been talked about? Is that a?
I mean, they know they're seeing them up there, and there are surveys. I mean, it's NEMAP. They're using NEMAP for the juvenile estimates, but the juvenile estimates that they have from here are not in the management plan as of right now, and that's why an addendum or an amendment would have to come out, because to use any of these new surveys, we'd have to do it. We'd have to do a change to the management plan.
Okay. Thank you.
But I agree. The more surveys you use, the better off, the better estimates you're
going to
get.
Chris has a question.
Yeah, this is a comment. Maybe I should save it for public comment, which is undoubtedly going to come. But I'll steer clear of croaker and just go with spot and say, every year our commercial fishery comes out about 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. If we're lucky, it's 8 weeks long. If you have a weather event, you could lose the whole 8 weeks. You take Matthew in 16. We had no spot fishery. If Florence had come north, we may not have had a spot fishery. These fish, I mean, they literally can vanish overnight. Ernie, please jump in and correct me if I'm wrong. You've been at this a lot longer than I have. But a spot is just it's a weather critical. So a lot of these populations, these catches, are based on weather events.
Yeah,
I mean, especially when it's such a short window. I mean, our entire spot season is, some years it's not 8 weeks long. It may be 6 weeks. And then from a recreational standpoint, when you look at the demographic of the fishermen, it's also moved into basically a September, October. You don't have the people targeting spot in June and July that we did. Those people, unfortunately, have either died or gone to do other fisheries. I mean, am I right, guys? I mean, the Lynnhaven Pier is gone. I mean, I don't know where that plays into the management of, say, below Windmill Point, but, or the catch... in the southern part of Virginia. But anyway, what I'm saying is there's so many factors with that fish in particular. And I could go on about croaker as well, but I think Mr. Amory covered it pretty well. And these are just, there's just so much other factors influencing this.
Right now, under the management plan, it has not triggered. under the present management plan the way it is on a coastwide plan. I see one person nodding their head. I see another person shaking their head. It has not triggered. But the TC, at the request of the board, looked at other factors, looked at could we do this regionally, if we look at it differently, if we look at, you know, and certainly when we did it regionally, there was an issue in the Mid-Atlantic. At least there appeared to be. Is it environmental? I fully agree with you. Croker and Spot are environmentally driven. You know, and it's, but it's, the numbers are down. You know, we're seeing those numbers are down, whether or not those, you know, it's a factor. No one's saying it's fishing. And does, you know, is it environmental? Somebody at the board actually said, how do we know we're not going down the same path as Weakfish? And it kind of made everyone stop for a second and think. We could do, you know, we could go ahead and put a management plan in effect that, because it's natural mortality. We don't know at this point. What we're doing at this point is just trying to gather information, hear from people, see what, you know, look at our data, look at the data that's available, and get comments from as many people as we can, so we can go back to this meeting and say what our stakeholders are thinking.
You know, you're a unique fisher with a spot. Basically, you're working on 1 year class.
Mm-hmm.
Almost all 90% of it's 1 year class. So you're real susceptible to big upswings and downturns. I've been gill netting for over 50 years. When I first started, I never saw a croaker in my life until I was probably 16. And then by the time I was probably 18 or 20, they were, you know, out of the woodwork. Trout were the same way. If you caught a 100-pound of trout in the fall of the year in a day, that was a lot. Then it got so 5,000 or 6,000 pounds was nothing. And now 100 pounds a lot again. Croakers, you know, stuff is going to come up and down, up and down.
Croaker is definitely cycling. Where's that one?
Straight bass, you're probably working on 15-year classes.
Yeah, I agree.
I just hate, I guess, and you have to educate me on that. Maybe the spotlight, stoplight type thing will factor that in, but it's just, it's hard to put regulations into something that is so volatile as this, and then you have us have a good year and not be able to react quick enough to benefit, you know?
Chris, that's why we're here, because there were people at that meeting in August that were all set to go ahead and say, okay, we're going to approve this amendment. We're going to approve, you know, this addendum to move forward with actions. And then some people going, well, what are those actions going to be? And nobody knew what they were yet. And then other people saying, I personally said, I didn't feel comfortable going forward not knowing what we might be going into. And that's why the thought was, let's take a step back, look at this. The TC provided everything they could to us. Go back and talk to our, you know, respective states and see what they have to say. And like I told you already, the South, they're saying, don't do a thing. It's fine. It's basically, you know, I haven't heard, North Carolina is a different, you know, I don't know about North Carolina, but Delaware, Maryland, Potomac River Fisheries Commission, some people here in Virginia are all saying, yeah, the numbers are down.
You know, we had a discussion a little bit about this a couple of years ago here when there was this, when they started to stop like red, yellow, and green. And at that time, we said we couldn't handle a minimum size. We'd have to go with a minimum count because variability in size, and you can't measure, you know, spot 230 per 100 pound. So if you caught 1,000 pound, the chances are you're not going to measure 2,300 fish. But some of them you're going to be able to eyeball and tell. But if you got them, like that. So if you made a count, 250 count or something, law enforcement could count them, and that way the variability would be taken care of. You just can't go with a minimum size on a fish that's that small. It's not like striped bass where if you catch 10, you made a day's work. If you catch 10 spot, you better eat them.
I think that seems to be a general.
That's the only way you're going to have a meal out of it is eat them.
Well, thanks for giving
recreational
us
the size limit issue there is bait.
That brings up an interesting topic. Is all of a sudden you have a size limit on a fish, and you catch it and want to use it for bait. Is it illegal if it's undersized?
Right.
Technically, yes.
Technically, yes, and especially if you've got them in a live well.
Yeah.
Because a lot of guys will cast net or set a fish trap and put them in a live well and keep them, you know, have an otter-proof box.
Yeah.
All right. Looks like that's it.
We'll be talking to you more about this. You know, we got to set up the scoping meeting or whatever we're going to do. We have to put together a big presentation for it where we show what we've seen recreationally and our state, what we've seen commercially, and do exactly what we're doing, asking folks what they think. Right. Then we can take it back to them. All right?
Thank you.
Thanks.
Rob, you had something to...
I waited for Pat to finally come around and say, Pat's pretty good effort. Which he finally did. So, you look at that graph again, you can make a case and broker that, if you do a 2 PUE catch per trip,
same.
It's going to be a much different impact than the harvest, which I think is a terrible part of the stoplight.
I have asked the TC chair to look at it several times. The problem is some states don't have good effort.
I can't believe VMAP isn't seasoned enough. We're talking about 2007 fall until now, so we've got 11 and a half seasons.
It's the use of juvenile.
Yeah, I heard you.
So it's I don't think they're going to be going further back, Rob, because I think as they bring these new data sets in, some of them only go. So I think they're almost, lopping off some of them. Like CMAP goes back to 89, and the ground fish survey goes back to the 60s.
So the assessments failed.
Yep.
Right?
Both of them.
And so how does that
get? It failed primarily because of the shrimp bycatch issue. And I was involved in the first one that they did for Kuroker, providing data and helping analyze it, and it failed remarkably miserably. It didn't pass at all. And this last one, the reviews said you did a much better job of analyzing this bycatch, but it's still not ready to go. And they said they could not recommend it for management use, but they didn't see the problem with the population at the time. It finished in 2017, so the terminal year might have been 2015. So it's until they get a handle on that bycatch issue, I don't think a full stock of 17 is going to pass. That's just my opinion.
Shouldn't.
Yep.
All right, thank you very much.
Talking about addendums and add-ons, the Coastal Shark Management Board meeting, August 8th, there were three main items. Actually, there was one main item on their agenda and two other items that really, I shouldn't say dog and pony, but NIMP provided an update to them. First, they approved draft amendment 5 for public comment. Contains the options. I'll go over those in a minute. The second was NOAA provided an update regarding the draft amendment 11, which is designed to rebuild the short fin mako stock by 2040. You haven't heard, NOAA by emergency action placed huge restrictions on the taking of makos, both commercially and recreationally. Essentially, the only legal commercial take of a short fin mako is one that, from the pelagic longline survey, then only if it's on a vessel that has an observer, and then the fish has to be, when it comes aboard, it's dead. The recreational fishery, and again, this is federal waters, they increase the minimum size limit to 83 inches, which corresponds to a mature female. That was in place through emergency for 6 months, and then they updated it, added another 6 months at the end of August. And it's just going to have the final rule published sometime late winter, early spring. Try to have it published before the second emergency expires. And they know also led a discussion for the board regarding the best practices for safe handling and release of coastal sharks from shore sites. Got a little more information on both the first, the addendum, and then the safe handling practices. Under the current Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission's Coastal Shark FMP, they annually set commercial quotas, possession limits, season dates. Generally at the annual meeting, which is usually in October, it's at that time that NOAA provides the specifications for the upcoming year, which they normally adopt by final rule in December, January time period. It's the quota specifications for the commercial fishery. However, all other changes to the commercial or any changes to recreational management can only be accomplished through an addendum or emergency action. Now, the addenda can be completed in a relatively short period of time, but the timing of the addenda and state implementation can result in inconsistencies between state and federal shark regulations, particularly when NOAA Fisheries adopts changes to interim management measures like it did with short fin Mako's. So there are three options in the draft addendum. One would be status quo. Continue as it is. We do annual specifications for the commercial quotas, possession limits, and commercial seasons. Option two would allow adjustment of all needed measures through annual specifications. That would include recreational size and possession limits, recreational seasons, area closures for both recreational and commercial, year specifications, both recreational and commercial, and effort controls, both recreational and commercial. Realizing that the plan already allows them to do the commercial quotas and commercial limits. Option three would do everything that option two does, but allow it to be done on an ad hoc, as needed basis. And it would also alter the annual setting of the commercial quotas, possession limits, and commercial seasons to the same process. It could be done at the annual meeting, but it could be done throughout the year. I really see this addendum as primarily a record-keeping impact, although there was questions raised by some states that they were concerned the public would be eliminated from the process in terms of comment, and they specified that either adoption of option two or three, it doesn't preclude the board from using the addendum period process. And every state rep is aware of their commercial fishery, and because it's something that would be implemented already by NOAA Fisheries, you'd have some idea to gauge how much interest there is by the public in terms of going through the longer process or just allowing them to be done annually or throughout the year.
Tom has a question.
Two questions, both kind of related. How do you do effort control on a recreational fishery? Commercial, you can say permits and things like that, but...
Set a season.
Okay, so...
Close season.
Okay, so that's close season for harvest. Are they talking about like strike bass, where if you even pretend you're think you're fishing for them, for sharks?
Deep waters, no. No, thinks they can do such things in federal waters, but
I mean, it's like no.
No,
you know.
If you're talking catch and release, and that's going to be lightly touched on the next pipe.
So harvest, I can absolutely agree with recreational fishery. Harvest is the key. You can control that, because then it's in the boat, in a cooler, you get a ticket.
And recreational, a lot of the recreational, even the harvest, but certainly the recreational catch is unintended bycatch. You put a piece of bait on a hook and put it in the water for something else, but guess what? A shark will eat that.
Red drum fishing.
Just try chumming. So yes, it's the actual harvest that we're talking about. But the board will take up this the three options, and I assume they'll vote for one of them. Again, I think it's really a matter of administration measures. Atlantic States doesn't really say that's one of the benefits, but I gotta believe there would be, to allow this rather than the addenda process, it would save their staff some time. It would save state personnel some staff time, even if only two members show up at any kind of public comment period they might have. But I'd like to hear you, any comments that you may have regarding.
Anybody else? Guess not.
But I think the one key was that the only concern and three options were, and the addendum five was the draft was adopted for public hearing, but that was the only concern by some states was, are we going to eliminate the public?
If you go with option two and you do everything universally for both recs and commercials, wouldn't that make it easier from an administrative point of view?
Are you asking me personally?
Yeah, I'm asking you personally and ask the individual standing there representing VMRC. So both of your questions.
I couldn't agree more.
Thank you. You have my opinion.
When you do it for some states that can't come into compliance except during the period when the legislature meets,
Legislature in Virginia doesn't get involved in sharks.
Legislature in Virginia
has
an appetite for menhaden, but not for sharks. So you have my opinion, option two.
It does for a number of them. Option two. I heard that. Okay. Now, next, this gets into a little bit of what Tom was asking about. Dusky sharks. Even though this wasn't a forward as a dusky shark issue, it really is all about dusky sharks. The harvest of dusky sharks commercially and recreationally has been prohibited for over a decade, but the stock remains overfished and overfishing is still occurring. Mortality from incidental interactions, release mortality, is assumed to be a major factor. Commercial gears have been excluded in some waters at certain times of the year to reduce handling mortality. And now NOAA is focusing on recreational angles to minimize their part of the equation, release mortality, with additional outreach, such as the use of circle hooks. They got into a pretty good discussion on proper handling technique. But at the same time, they want the anglers to be safe, particularly if they're landing some of the larger sharks from shore. And there's some of it in Virginia, but I'll tell you what, in some states, there's quite a, let's call it a niche fishery, beach shore fishing.
Yeah, Delaware.
Large, well, you hit it on the head because they have all the sand tigers in there.
Yeah.
And I think social media has played a real role because you can turn out some bad, well, eye-popping, I can't believe this crazy guy is doing that.
Right.
Kinds of videos for 1 minute, and then the guy gets 10 million hits, and he's a hero in a millisecond. So that's
my landing approach for big sharks is a knife on the line.
Well, that's one of the recommended. Now, just cut it as close to the shark as you can do safely, and let them go on the way, and don't put them on the beach. But that's one thing they did come up, and it was the committee members sort of joked with. This was proposing these signs to go up on the beaches, and particularly, I think it was a New York state representative saying, well, you know, as soon as you put that up there, all you're setting yourself up for is target practice, so they're using the targets. They said, well, what we're more likely to do is to come up with something, you know, kind of eye-catching, like be fast, is put it in the tackle shops. They'll support it, but it's all about outreach, as you said. You know, you're catching these fish. How can I not catch them if they're there? And I put a hook in the water. So, but the dusky shark in particular has been problematic in that it hasn't responded to non-harvest for over a decade. The sandbar, which is another common shark here, at least it's responded, is still considered overfished, but overfishing is no longer occurring. You've got a pretty good buildup of a lot of juvenile fish here in the mid-Atlantic region.
You've seen the guy in the bow picker, the El Patras at Salvation, or a griffin. He does a cooperative study with NOAA. They're doing a lot of duskies and sandbars both.
He's tagging them?
Mm-hmm. He's helping them. They're killing them. I mean, they're tagging, they're releasing some, tagging some, but then in the process of fishing, I mean, then he's able to sell them. He's got a special permit. He's on Instagram. You have to check him out. But you got to check him out.
It's kind of like the research set aside is for the sandbar sharks.
Yes.
That commercial fishermen have to take a NOAA person aboard,
yeah,
and they're limited to a certain number, but then they can sell, keep them and sell the catch.
Yeah. A lot of theories amongst some of this, but I mean, I don't know. Well, anyway.
Go ahead.
Long night. Nope. We got to get out of here.
All right,
Lewis.
And that's just, you know, that gives you an idea, and that's not anywhere close to as egregious a picture you can get. But shark's way up on the beach. He's obviously been out on the water for a while, and they're just not as tough animals as some people think. They might not die immediately, but you drag them up on the beach, sand their gills, not a good thing.
Which one is that?
Pardon me?
What type is that?
You know, from there, I can't tell for sure. If I had to guess, that sure looks like a sandbar.
It is a sandbar. Look at the dorsal fin.
Well, I know, but is it a, can you see the ridge back on it? You can't with it.
Yeah, I still think it's a sandbar.
You can't see. Well, I do too. But I can't
definitively,
and I would picture the robustness of the head, relation of the fin, pec fin, and the size.
Okay. All right, sir. Is that it?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much.
Sharks is just like the shark patch in 89 when they were telling us, just wait, you don't have to do this. And why are you going to come back? Remember that? The sharks are they're 5 years. They're late and all this. They're going to be coming back. They already are.
Okay, this is my turn to go, I guess. All right. Now, on the cable route, there's not a whole lot to add right now. They've finished 1, 2, and 3 sections, or sections 1, 2, and 3. They've gone back for some infill data, as they call it. They expect to have the rest of it done within a week if they have decent weather, which they're not getting right now. But once they've surveyed it all, then they'll analyze the data, decide what they have to go back and pick up or how to handle whatever they come up with on the bottom. And then they'll set a schedule for that. But it's for right now, it's just, well, it's weather and a federal, some kind of Navy practice that's going on. It's see what he calls that, a fleet forces restriction that prohibits them from doing, I guess, the areas from 3 further out to 10. So as soon as those let up, the weather lets up, a week's worth of work, they'll be through with the preliminary surveys and the follow-up infill data where they go in to get what little they may have missed. And then they'll decide what to do, and we'll go from there. We're not getting any information on the actual wind sites yet. That's up to Dominion and those people to decide when they're going to release that and tell us more about it.
What is this cable? What is this?
This is the cable out to the west wind turbines.
Okay, like the power. Sorry, I thought.
Yeah. Right.
For the proposed wind farm areas.
Well, there's two test turbines that are going up for sure.
When?
Hopefully next year. They think they can get them up in a day, actually, with the foundations that they're using.
Wow.
And then they have to get them wired in, of course, and all of that stuff. And I don't know how long it'll take to get the cable in.
We don't know where those are going to be exactly.
Yeah, it's about 12 miles off. Actually, I've got a paper that shows it a little better if you want, but I'll give that to you in a little bit.
Jeff, have they done anything about restrictions or distance restrictions about How close you'll be able to get to those after they're up yet?
That's my next question.
There's no change yet, and it sounds like it'll be like the oil rigs in the Gulf. You can fish right up against them. You just can't tie up to them.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yeah, it is. It's good news. It'll make some good habitat. I wish they're using monopiles, which is what you see in most of the wind sites that you see pictures of. It's a one big pile driven into the ground, and it's about these will be about 20 feet in diameter, I think. Okay. The other one would be like they used in New England, which is a 4 or 5-legged platform that they set them on, which from a fishing standpoint would give you a lot better habitat.
Right.
The other good thing about the 5-legged platforms, the jack piles or whatever, is that it doesn't make as much sound damage when they drive them in, but you also don't have the wash away from the soil, away from the scour, as they call it, around those that you do have on around a 20-foot single pile. But the single piles, they tell me you can they have, when they have the ships there, they can drive a pile in and get it set in a day.
That's unbelievable.
It is, and of course they're humongous ships that they use, but. The only other thing that there's a fishery liaison officer who is Wolfgang Rain is his name, and he's been sending me the emails that I pass on to you. And he says part of the problem is once they start the survey, they have about 3 times the depth of cable to go back to the survey equipment. And if there's any more than in a 10-degree turn, they have to stop, go back, and go straight on to the 10-degree turn, to the next section. They can't tow in a 10-degree right-hand turn or left-hand turn. So it's pretty elaborate, but they're used to it. So a week should tie it up. And that's all I have so far.
Okay.
If you're on my list where I send these out to, if you're not on it, you want to be, let me know. If you are on it, you want to get off, let me know that too. Okay, great. And that's it for me. So, for any other old business?
I have another new business.
Okay.
It's along the same lines, only more local. Plum Tree Island National Wildlife Refuge, and it used to be the bombing range. They had a public hearing about it, I want to say about a month ago, and I attended it. The interesting thing there is that they had a first thing, the guy from the Army Corps, made it very clear that they would never say that the area was actually cleaned up, period. We can never say with absolute certainty that it's going to be safe to do anything there.
So that's one thing. Another is that the area of that has ordinance on it that they're concerned goes almost all the way across the mouth of Back River and further out than what is then, and it's in areas that are historically Hall Saint areas. And also, he was surprised to hear that Hall Saint's actually set a pocket. And, you know, put poles in the bottom and set a pocket. He's like, oh, they don't do that. Oh, yes, they do. You need to go watch sometime. But they also, I would suggest one thing, and I'll talk to Steve about it because it's more of a habitat issue, that the agency come up with a protocol. This is kind of a, well, the agency come up with a protocol to permit people to set duck blinds back up inside there, where they have to get the area where they're going to set the duck blind surveyed for unexploded ordnance before they can set it. You know, they could pay somebody to come out there, survey it, and say, because they have taken all the duck blinds out of the area, and the rules now are you can't disturb the bottom. That's what the Army Corps says. What VMRC's regulation says is you can't even go in the area, and they need to fix that so that it's consistent. But the other thing is, if you want to set a duck blind, because they threw people that had duck blinds for generations and they're out, that you could do it, but you have to get the area surveyed so that you know that where you're setting it is not going to have unexploded ordnance on it. But it's the whole eastern side of the island is kind of, or southeast corner is all goofed up, and it's. Like I said before, when they first came in three or four years ago, they're doing their best to close off the area to everything. Right. And commercial fishermen right now have an exemption to set gill nets and crab pots and Hall Saints in the area, and I don't understand how a gill net anchor is any different than a recreational boat anchor. But what do I know?
All right. Any other new business? Yes.
I was just curious, tomorrow during the VMRC, they've got an item about hook and line proposal to have a public hearing. I called and they said it was some clarification to the language about the 2-year 1,000-pound requirement. Is that not it? Or? Obviously would have had that license because the requirement is to make 1,000 pounds the previous I don't see the modernization. You know, the modernization is that what I'm hearing is that people are being held to a date. In other words, if somebody comes in July and they've been fishing since January, from January through July, and they've apprenticed, worked for another fisherman, whatever it is, and say they're going to buy a commercial card with a number of licenses attached to it, they're being told that that doesn't count, that it has to go back to the calendar year. It goes back to, you know, the January. Right. And I don't remember that being our intent.
That's 2010.
Yeah.
So the new regulation will say 2 years an anniversary date of this, or it'll say...
No, that already was done in 2010.
Okay.
The amendment is merely to make it clear that if you transfer a hook and line license, it's not only the person who accepts the transfer, it's also the person who makes the transfer that has to meet that £1,000. And that is definitely the intent all along. It's just that for some reason, that just rolled along for 20 years or 19 years. So that's what's going on. I can't see going backwards on the 24 months to go back to that, quite frankly, but that's the way it's been since 2010.
I guess that's...
Well, if you don't let me ask a question on that. You know, most years you have a lottery where there's certain licenses that are lost and stuff. Is that only offered to people who had the 1,000 pound to catch? Or is that open to anybody who had a card?
You have to have the 1,000 pounds to catch or sales of seafood. And that was also established for commission action to make that clear. That was another, I think there have been seven amendments.
So the general concept there was to stop someone who's a recreational fisherman.
I don't know what or
not.
Was.
Well, I was in the meetings. Just imply the...
It was because of the fact that what's good for the transfer for and the transferee should be good for the lottery person. I mean, you have to have your CFRL.
I agree with all that. I get it, you know, and that I don't have any problems with that. In I guess because it's there. I mean, the whole thing is a bunch of stipulations on one gear type that don't exist for a lot of others, for political reasons and/or to stymie recreational use. I don't know. It's unbelievable to me that, you know, 200 licenses can cause, you know, and I'm getting to where I'm getting some more time in life. I might be ready to revisit this whole thing again, yeah. But you know, I don't mind. I'm not scared of it. You know, but it just when people want to get out of the fishery, and you got somebody who's been fishing who has 1,000, and the person who wants to get out has 1,000, and they can't do it because the 1,000 wasn't, you know, certain because it didn't fall on January 5th or before January 5th. Yeah, it's just unbelievable to me. You know, all this was just, all it is just ways to tie hands, you know, people, you know, because that's what the mission was. It was easy. It's 24 months. It was easy.
Evaluation of that and the commission action on that, it's
Yeah, I get it. I know. And it was, and it was. Yeah, both of them.
So you know that the reason there's 200 licenses was because the task force was composed of various interests in different species, and there were all sorts of restrictions put on. And when it started out, it certainly wasn't contemplated that it was a way for circumvention of the baggage. That really wasn't part of the intention of the task force. So, but we can talk about it, and I'll be happy to give that information. I know it won't quell your situation over 24 months, but it was a tough time for us to figure that out. It really was.
No, it did, but it's just like the bottlenose dolphin tank reduction team. You know, these details that people overlooked at the time, you know, we sat there and, you know, for, I believe it's, you know, for the harbor porpoise, you know, they used the bridge tunnel. And then we said emphatically and, you know, over and over, we wanted to keep the same line, you know, in these, you know, when we're in the middle of all these meetings, you know, the general flavor and the way we want to go doesn't ultimately wind up in the end. But then everybody says, oh, no, that's what we agreed on. And so now we've got bottlenose dolphin uses lighthouse to lighthouse, and right, you know, harbor porpoise uses the bridge tunnel. And to most people, it's no big deal. But it is a big deal because this causes confusion. You know, and it's in a huge inconvenience. And that's what this 20...
Yeah, I'm going, that's what I'm not, I know.
And that's, oh, yeah, you were there.
Deer,
we said it.
And, deer mesh greater than seven? What's large mesh?
Yeah, but... Yeah, but I'm not naive enough, and you know it because you heard the people say it. They geared those things to make it difficult for fishermen. There was a motive. I heard them. I heard what's their name. Well, the more confusing it is, the more easily it will be to, you know, to nah, whatever. They know what they're doing. It's just another example of the minutia that affects people's lives and the way they make a living. It's not just a sport, you know. Okay, so that's why it deserves the time and the attention, you know, that this committee is formed for. You know, it's details like this because they end up causing a lot of heartache and hardship for people.
All right, I'm sure that'll be considered. All right, appreciate it. Any other new business, old business? Motion to adjourn. Second. All right, that's it. Thank you very much. Next meeting, no idea, right?
Next meeting,
you have to get you down, all right? All right.
What's
that
now?
Wrong form. Yeah, basically. You know, that's the way they want it. Nice to see you. Yeah. Sure. Okay, great. Yeah. I appreciate that. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. I would have beat the bush. I'd have known. I would have made it through the phone.
Thank you.
Yeah, because, you know, it's a species that fills this room on occasion. You know what I mean? We fill this room when it's, you know, and I would have filled it that night with people, and now I've got to get on the phone and do something even harder.
It's new, or
I've
got
to get them to sit down at the computer and write something.
What about Mike Avery? I'm the chairman of that club. That's what I was showing you. This was our.
Spelled it out, right? In other words,
he has everything in there.
Sure. Yeah,
if you
I
want it.
Yeah,
if you want it, you can have it.
Yeah, that'd be great. I appreciate right. that. Yeah.
And those are the comments that we're submitting to NOAA. The only thing is, it'll be on our letterhead.
I got you.
That was pretty comprehensive what he put in there, so
we didn't waste any time.
I want
to get a copy of your chart on effort for both Spot and Croker, because we've now signed somebody to take those two up since
the
phone
meeting.
And
all
that's fine. That's fine. I just gave you two. Okay. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. We typically get involved in just about any regulation on anything, and you won't take long for you to find out we're vehemently opposed to Menhaden regulations being
where they are in Virginia, and I have an excellent relationship with Steve Bowen, so
he knows how we feel. Strickler knows how we feel. Welcome to Virginia.
Section of states is going to have its own group.
Right, and they'll have to fund a meeting.
And good luck in your job.
Well, they're going to fund the state group. They're not going to fund the Netherlands. I guess they figure there's duplication. So I expect to hear something from them.
Right.
Oh, thanks for all your work.
Tom, have a good night.